It's a family affair, a couple of times removed. Hi, I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. Today I speak with Richard Michael Levine, longtime journalist who has moved into the realm of fiction with his latest book, The Man Who Gave Away His Organs, Love and Obsession at Midlife. Later in the broadcast, I'll talk with author and poet Lucille Lang Day, who has just published Dreaming of Sunflowers, Museum Poems, and Becoming an Ancestor. Lucy and I share a name and maybe a lot more. And by the way, Lucy and Richard are married. So it's a family affair, and I hope you'll stay with us. Richard Michael Levine has appeared extensively in publications such as Harper's, The Atlantic, and Esquire, where he was a contributing editor. He's been a staff writer and an editor at Newsweek and the Saturday Review. And he is the author of the true crime bestseller, Bad Blood, A Family Murder in Marin County. I recently sat down with him to talk about his book of fiction, released from Capra Press, The Man Who Gave Away His Organs, Love and Obsession at Midlife. Here is our conversation. Richard Michael Levine, welcome.
Thank you.
We are here to talk about your latest book, The Man Who Gave Away His Organs, Tales of Love and Obsession at Midlife. I began reading this book, but it was bothering me that I hadn't read your other book, Bad Blood, A Family Murder in Marin County. Uh-huh. And so once I started reading Bad Blood and then went back to your book of fiction, I couldn't divorce them because I felt your voice so much and a lot of similar themes. So I'd like to back you up a little bit so our readers who might not be familiar with your book, Bad Blood, it is the story of a family murder of two teenagers who murdered a couple, Marlene's parents. And this happened in Terralinda. And so you have a background in journalism, but what drew you to this particular story?
It had a lot of elements that interested me at the time. Youth culture at that time with Marlene's very bright girl who wrote wonderful poetry. And I knew that I could use that as an element in the book that would work for me. And the story was very compelling, I think, because here was, you know, a young couple, neither of whom I think really intended the murder to happen. She was just goading him on, and he was the kind of somewhat hapless guy whose first girlfriend she was, and he took her up on killing her parents in a way that I don't think she expected him to. That was interesting to me.
And did you encounter the story in the newspaper like many other people and decided to kind of pursue that?
I wrote it first as a magazine article, and it didn't seem like I had finished with it after the magazine article. There were too many other elements to it that I liked. And so I decided to try it as a book.
Well, it certainly works as a book. And for our readers who might like true crime books, this is one you might want to catch. And largely because of the way the story unfolds and the way you have it unfold. And I think that's where I really did feel a connection between this earlier work of nonfiction and the stories you bring forth in The Man Who Gave Away His Organs.
Well, I think that's true. It's narrative nonfiction, Bad Blood, and told very much like a novel. And I feel that all of the journalism that I've done, I've never done newspaper journalism. I'm not sure I would know how to do it. And I'm not terribly interested in the immediacy of newspaper journalism. I have done a lot of magazine journalism for Esquire and Harper's Magazine and other magazines. That's principally what I've done before I turned to book writing. And even in the magazine work, what interested me most was plot, the narrative line of a story. So in a sense, the books just continued that. And there didn't seem to me even that much of a difference between writing nonfiction and writing fiction, because the pull of the narrative was equally strong in both.
In Bad Blood, it's interesting to me whenever a book starts out with a crime, so you know whether it's fiction or not fiction, nonfiction, it starts out with the end in a way, but as we're pulled through, we want to deny that inevitability of what's going to happen and maybe say, no, turn back, but we know what's coming and that colors everything we read.
Well, I think that was the point. It starts out for me with a really brutal murder. And as the book progresses, that murder seems inevitable in a way. And the interest in the book is how it becomes inevitable.
And we get to know the victims. We get to know
the
victims quite
well.
And how long did it take you to put that book together?
It took me a few years to write it. It was a hard book to write in the sense that I needed to do a lot of research. I had to talk to a lot of people, not just Marlene and Chuck. And there are elements. There's a trial that's a prominent part of the book, and I had to deal with that. And hypnosis becomes a prominent part of the trial, so I had to learn about that. There were a lot of elements that I had to tie together and a fair amount of research to do.
And in the book, your voice is definitely recognizable, especially when one reads your latest book, The Man Who Gave Away His Organs. I think you have such a strong voice, and the language just leads you through.
Well, I'm glad you used the word voice, because that's crucial to me, and I think it's crucial to any book that I read, and I think most readers read. The voice of a writer is somewhat undefinable, but really very distinct, and it's that voice, if it's compelling enough, that draws you into the work.
And we're talking, of course, about your voice. And that even in this earlier work of nonfiction, that was a strong voice and some of the same elements, I'll say, of wit were present there, and kind of a sardonic wit definitely present in this book of short stories.
Yes, I hope that the book touches on all the whole gamut of emotions, from lighthearted, humorous aspect of it to sad and even tragic aspects of it. So I think that's true in both books.
The Man Who Gave Away His Organs, Tales of Love and Obsession at Midlife. The stories have some elements of absurdity at times, or I'll even say flights of fantasy, but they're grounded in the real that each one of us experiences in life.
Yes, I think there are strong autobiographical elements in all of the stories, some of them more so than others. In a sense, all fiction is autobiographical because it's written by someone and his or her experiences. But in this case, some of the stories are more autobiographical than others, things that actually happened to me or that I happened to friends of mine or even that I heard about and that I used as a jumping off point to imagine a different or more distinct ending.
The common threads are really the ones we all deal with on a day-to-day basis and are unavoidable.
Right.
Death, yes. Loss.
Yes, exactly.
Children. Well, can we get a taste of can you read something for us and tell us what you might want to read for us today?
Maybe I'll read an excerpt if I can find it here from Jeopardy.
Oh, good.
This is the middle of the story, really. I'm not starting at the beginning. The mother, Edith, is in a rehabilitation hospital after, I think, breaking her hip. And this takes place, and she likes Jeopardy and watches it there. And this takes place, part of it takes place when the mother and the son are watching Jeopardy together. I wheeled Edith back to her room. Just after 7, she turned on Jeopardy. Alex Trebek was looking especially natty in a double-breasted charcoal blazer, blue shirt, brown tie, and matching pocket handkerchief, and his comfortably retro, lightly tinted aviator glasses. The category they started with was what you ought to know. For $200, Alex Trebek said, squeeze these radiator attachments and replace them if they go soft on you. What are the hoses? I said. That may be it for me on cars. Next category, please. What are the hoses? A contestant said. Correct, Alex Trebek said. For $400, the movie The Love Bug humanizes this 1963 car. None of the contestants responded. What is a Volkswagen Beetle? Edith said, almost reluctantly. I'm sorry, Alex Trebek said, sounding a little disappointed but not reproachful. The answer is, what is a Volkswagen Beetle? Remember the tried and true bug. Now for $600, also the name of a comic strip. It makes the pistons up and down motion circular. What is a crankshaft? Edith said. What is a crankshaft? The contestant said. Correct, Alex Trebek said. For $800, in Goldfinger, James Bond modified this 1965 car to include machine guns, a hydraulic battering ram, and an ejector seat. What is a Rolls-Royce? A contestant said. Alex Trebek shook his head and crinkled his eyes understandingly. What is a Bentley? Another contestant said. What is an Aston Martin? Edith said. I'm sorry, Alex Trebek said. The correct answer is what is an Aston Martin? A silver one, if memory serves. Finally, for $1,000, throttle body is one type of this delivery system of gas to the engine. He waited patiently, but nobody answered. What is fuel injection? Edith said. I'm sorry, Alex Trebek said. The answer is what is fuel injection? A bell rang, signaling the end of the round. We'll take a short break, players, Alex Trebek said. Better luck next time when we come back for Double Jeopardy. I must have looked astonished. What's wrong? Edith asked. I didn't know you knew anything about cars. You couldn't live with your father and brother without knowing something about cars. We were both still facing the TV. I guess I never realized you were paying attention, I said. I was, she said. Were you? She gave me a quick glance and turned away. I looked at her, not knowing how to respond and hoping she wouldn't press the issue. Well, why weren't you? She asked. Tell me, you knew what was going on. I was a kid, Mom. I was your mother, she said, looking at me. Her face was reddening around the edges of her powdered cheeks. I didn't want to lose either of you. You didn't want to lose him. Why should I have been forced to? Who else could I have turned to? She asked, her voice breaking. You can't turn to a little kid, Mom. You could have left. I couldn't have left. How? You needed a father. We needed a family. I tried to protect you as much as I could. She didn't say anything.
That particular short story was something many of us experience in one way or another as our parents age.
And also the double, I mean, it's a TV show, and also it's the title of the story, because that's what the people are in always. And it ends that way, if I can just read
yes.
a little bit more from the very end of it. Edith is about to get out of the hospital. As soon as I was sure my mother was out of danger, I packed up and hugged her goodbye and took a taxi to the airport. With another orange alert having been declared a few days earlier, the passengers were all scrutinizing one another as they filed dutifully through security. We're all old people now, always in jeopardy. So I think jeopardy works on different levels in the story.
This story and at least one other includes the death of a child.
That's right.
And that one, Tulak, which I thought might be a mountain someplace at first when I started reading it. But talk a little bit about this short story. Whereas Jeopardy felt grounded in the real, this feels a little bit more that it takes off in a different direction, but out of the same place of maybe a lot of pain.
Yes. You know, it's a story about a husband and wife who spent a year or so early in their marriage in a remote Mexican town in the mountains around Oaxaca, and where the husband was doing research for his PhD. And Tlac is kind of a made-up name for a pre-Columbian god. They deal then with the death of their son, and the story is about how differently they deal with it. It's somewhat autobiographical also, in the sense that my brother died, not as young as the son in this story, but still young enough in his early 30s. And my parents dealt with it very differently, my father more resiliently, and my mother, it kind of became her excuse to allow her depression to deepen. And there's a kind of mythological element in Tlac where the mother uses a pre-Columbian ritual to try to reconnect with her son. So it's a story that begins realistically and takes off into a kind of fantasy.
I think there's one other story that I would like you to talk a little bit about, and that was the Irving Horowitz support group.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
That also started, it's a good example of how something in your life can you lead you on to a story or even a novel. And in my case, I met a woman in a coffee shop in Berkeley and started talking to her. This was a woman I eventually lived with for a number of years, but in this initial contact, it took a while before she asked my name, and I said, Richard Levine. And she practically fell over in her chair because she had just been divorced, messily divorced, from a Richard Levine. So I thought, well, you know, there are probably a lot of other Richard Levines out there, and maybe it would be I changed the name to Irving Horowitz, and wouldn't it be interesting if they had a support group? And all the Irving Horowitzes came together in this support group. What would have result? That's what prompted the story.
But it takes a turn, and it also has to do with many of the stories in the book have to do with the relationship, the delicate relationship between a man and a woman, and which you explore in many of these stories. But I want to encourage our listeners and our readers to pick up The Man Who Gave Away His Organs, the title story, which we have not spoken about. The title story, The Man Who Gave Away His Organs, Tales of Love and Obsessions at Midlife. Anything you want to say about that story, The Man Who Gave Away His Organs?
Well, that came from a newspaper article that I read where some guy had donated first blood. And then talked about donating maybe sperm for a sperm bank, I think. And I forget exactly, but at some point his wife became kind of annoyed with him. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting to explore the dynamic of a guy who at the beginning was not very, he was an accountant and a numbers person and not very philanthropic, but gets more and more involved in this kind of activity where he is giving away parts of himself. You can give away a fair amount of yourself and still exist quite healthfully.
Again, in this one, there's a dynamic between the husband and the wife.
That's right.
That sometimes, even when there's love between two people, there's often separation.
Yes. People react to an event, in the one case, the death of a child, so differently that they grow into different people than they started out as, or aspects of themselves that were always there become exaggerated, and it causes a problem in the relationship that they have to either work out or if not, the relationship sometimes explodes.
Well, there's a lot more here in this book of stories. Do you want to do a little additional reading for us?
Yes. I live in Berkeley or Oakland, and the Golden Bear Recreation Center is the pool of the University of California at Berkeley, that I would both run around the track at some point for many years above the pool, and then when my knees started to hurt, took up swimming. The swimming pool is right below the track. So this is not the start of the story, but close to the start of the story, and the hero, or protagonist, I guess, is a guy named Summers, who takes up swimming much as I did when he can no longer run as easily as he ages. As he regained his breath, Summers received the real prize of his runs, a newborn world. He became aware of his deep, unhurried inhalations, the prickle of sweat cooling on his skin, the lyres of sprinkler spray in the infield, plucked by faint rainbows of mist, the drops of water that turned the lawn into a field of tiny diamonds. He breathed in a musky new mown grass and fertilizer odor, and the cough drop tang of a nearby eucalyptus grove. For the first time, he became aware of a flock of fawn-colored goats stripping the yellowing grass from the steep hill that rose along one length of the track, a flock the city rented at the start of the fire season from a clever fellow who followed the spring north, fattening his animals for hefty fees. The sound of goats munching dry grass reminded him of the rustle of tutus at the ballet. He was still under this endorphinated spell when he came to the section of the track that overlooked a university-owned swimming pool. It was a beautiful pool, a David Hockney painting of the perfect California pool. Its six broad lanes were divided by alternating blue and yellow floats, the school colors. The turquoise bottom of the pool gave its tint to the water, and the breeze-rippled surface cast a squiggly web of refracted light on the bottom and liquefied the lines of black tiles running down the middle of each lane. The pool itself looked out on the whole of the Bay Area, the white hills of San Francisco to the south and the lion-maned Marin Hills to the north, joined by the Golden Gate Bridge, straight ahead. In the late afternoon hour that summers usually ran, an equally exhausted orange sun ignited the bay. On foggy days, the whole panorama was erased by a smear of gray, as if God vowed to do better in the morning. One day when he reached the corner of the track that gave him the best view of the pool, Summer saw a lone, long-legged co-ed whose yellow bathing cap and blue two-piece swimsuit matched the lane dividers. Holding onto a kickboard and paddling with oversized orange fins, her head held high above the water, she moved up and down the pool as smoothly as a fairy tale swan. She was wearing sunglasses. A short time later, Summer noticed her drive out of the parking lot in a vintage white Cadillac convertible with red leather seats and, again, enormous fins that made the car look like some sort of medieval weapon in retreat. Her towel was wrapped around the bathing suit she still wore, and what appeared to be a violin case was lying on the back seat. Summers was smitten. But he was also wary. It wasn't easy being a middle-aged professor in the land of the young. Half-clothed, tattooed, and muscled co-eds looked like pin-ups superimposed on sailors, their bobbing breasts winking at him mischievously. They warded off his friendly overtures by calling him sir. "Please call me Summers," he would plead. "Yes, sir," they'd reply. Occasionally, they could turn downright sadistic, as it happened earlier that week when Summers had been idling away an hour between classes reading a newspaper in his favorite outdoor cafe. A particularly winsome young lady sat down nearby with a motto written across her skimpy T-shirt that he couldn't quite make out. As nonchalantly as possible, he put on his distance glasses, and the words leapt into sharp focus. "Join the Dirty Old Man Club." The girl flashed Summers a gotcha grin. Summers saw this Finn lady the next day and the day after. On the fourth day, he paid for a daily pass and entered the pool area. The kickboarder's yellow bathing cap turned out to be a helmet of short blonde hair, and she herself, not a student, but a woman in her late 30s, he guessed, with freckled shoulders and a fetching overbite. Up close, where Summers could see the effort involved, she moved less like a swan than an efficiently putt-putting motorboat. This is a love story, as it goes on, and not only a love story between the mother, between the two adults, but also a love story between the woman's daughter and Summers.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much for reading that. And we haven't gotten into your poetry, and we can do that another time. But I want to remind our listeners that the book that we're talking about is The Man Who Gave Away His Organs, Tales of Love and Obsession at Midlife. We're talking with Richard Michael Levine. And we mentioned and talked a little bit about his book, Bad Blood, A Family Murder in Marin County, which I want to recommend as well. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Suzanne. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it.
All right.
Richard Michael Levine and his book is The Man Who Gave Away His Organs, Love and Obsession at Midlife. We'll take a short break and then talk with poet Lucille Lang Day, who first came to our attention with the publication of her memoir, Married at 14, A True Story. Please stay with us. I'm Suzanne Lang, possibly related to Lucille Lang Day. And it's KRCB's A Novel Idea.
When despair grows in me, and I wake in the middle of the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, go and lie down.
We've listened to a little of Crooked Still with The Peace of Wild Things from the album Friends of Fall. Acclaimed poet Lucille Lang Day was last on a novel idea when she published the improbable story of her life, Married at 14, A True Story, which was her candid account of her young life. Lucy has an MA in English and an MFA in creative writing from San Francisco State, and her BA in biological sciences, another master's in zoology, and a PhD in science and mathematics education from Berkeley. But she was a rebellious teenager who dropped out of school and married at 14 and had a child at 15. Despite that beginning, Lucille Lang Day has gone on to be a science educator, encouraging young girls in particular to pursue math and science. And she has emerged as an award-winning poet. She's got a couple of new poetry volumes out, Dreaming of Sunflowers, Museum Poems, and Becoming an Ancestor. Last time she was at the studio, just through casual conversation about our shared name, we discovered that our family stories of our ancestors were very similar, tracing back to Germany and a Baron von Lang. So I was so interested to have her come back with her book, Becoming an Ancestor. Here's our conversation.
Lucille Lang Day, it is just exciting to have you back in the studio.
Thank you.
And you have a couple of new things out. You have do you call this a chapbook? Dreaming of Sunflowers, Museum Poems?
Yes, that one's a chapbook, and that just means that it's a short poetry collection.
And you have a volume of poetry out called Becoming an Ancestor, and I know you're going to read a little bit for us today, but can we talk a little bit about ancestors?
Sure.
And because it seems like you may have dived deep into your ancestral waters here.
Yes, partly by luck and partly by research, I've identified a lot of my ancestral lines. My mother's father had ancestors that came here on the Mayflower, but her mother was a half Wampanoag, so I'm descended both from the Mayflower Pilgrims and from the Wampanoag Indians who helped them survive in North America. And there's a lot of research out there that's been done both by people interested in genealogy and also by relatives of mine about those Mayflower lines and the ancestors on that side. And then on the other side, on my father's side, my father's mother, Ada Peckham Lang, was a descendant of John Peckham, another really early person in North America who joined the Anne Hutchinson Party in 1639 and was among the first settlers of Rhode Island. And he was descended from an English nobleman. And then on my father's father's side, that's the Lang lineage, and that is where I think I might be related to you, because my father's father, whose name was William Lang, the story he told was that his father, Christian Lang, was the son of a German baron, whose name was Baron von Lang. The name was originally von Lang. And apparently Baron von Lang was fighting on the wrong side when King Wilhelm was unifying Germany. And so my great-grandfather Christian Lang and his wife Anna Lang had to flee Germany. And they first went to Switzerland, and then they went from there to Paterson, New Jersey. And that's where my grandfather Bill Lang was born.
And I'll disclose to our listeners that I, in my family story, my father's name was Bill Lang, and that we have a von Lang element to our kind of family story. And so it was just too coincidental when we discovered this. But to have ancestors that you can trace back that far, how does that change how you perceive yourself?
That's a really interesting question. I always thought of myself as a being newly made, and I thought of myself as possibly doing things that are more significant than the things my ancestors did, whoever they were. And I think that it isn't true at all. I feel humbled by them, by my ancestors. That my ancestors include apparently a Wampanoag chief, a German baron, the people who wrote the Mayflower Compact. They clearly had much better leadership skills than I could ever dream of, and they had a lot of survival skills too. They survived under rough circumstances often. I'm not sure that I would survive that same way. I'm not sure that I have that much resourcefulness to know where to go to start a new life or to fight back when things are going terribly wrong.
Really?
Really?
Because I sometimes wonder about the importance of this when so many people are getting maybe genetic testing even to find their deep ancestors,
right,
or there's these ancestry.com and that sort of thing. And I wonder if it somehow makes us perceive ourselves differently, stronger, weaker. I mean, did it make you feel like you have something great in you from them that maybe you didn't think about before?
Yes, definitely. It makes me think I've got some, I've received some good gifts from them. And I have done DNA testing too, and that was particularly important in showing my Native American ancestry, because my mother's mother, who was half Wampanoag, was the illegitimate daughter of a Caucasian woman and a Wampanoag man. And so her mother's name appears on her birth certificate. Her name, my mother's mother, was born Rachel Emma Sampson, and her birth certificate says that she's the daughter of Anjanette Sampson, an unmarried woman. So I did DNA testing to show, which came out showing that I am 12% Native American, which strongly corroborates this family story.
So here you are with this deep ancestry that you've discovered, and then you have family beyond you. So you are going to be an ancestor,
right,
yourself.
Yes. And so my book, Becoming an Ancestor, isn't only about my ancestors, but about my contemporary family, about my descendants, including immediately my grandchildren, and it's about mortality. The book is definitely about mortality.
Something we all have in common.
Yes.
With our ancestors, too. Well, let's please read us something from Becoming an Ancestor.
Okay, I'll read the first poem in the book, which is called Journeys, and it gives an overview of my ancestors, and it's dedicated to my parents, Evelyn and Richard Lang. And it starts with an epigraph: "The past is never dead; it's not even past." And that's from William Faulkner, "Requiem for a Nun." Journeys. Rivers glitter. A warm rain spurs hunter-gatherers to migrate out of Africa, past the Red Sea, toward unnamed fields and seasons. Their descendants polish tools, plant peas and wheat, which starts the Neolithic Revolution. It says so in all the rings my mother gave me of mitochondrial DNA. Glaciers take up so much water, my ancestors can walk across the Bering Strait. Through centuries, they walk without a map or compass, all the way to Massachusetts, arriving thousands of years before my Anglo-Saxon forebears take their gods and goddesses to Sussex, long before John and Peter de Peckham joined the Third Crusade. In a heaving sea, John Howland is swept off the Mayflower. He grabs a halyard. The crew snags his clothes with a boat hook to drag him back to the deck. In my double helices, he feasts with wampanoags on venison, roast goose, wild turkey, pumpkin, squash, plums, and berries under oaks with scarlet leaves. John Peckham renounces his father, lord of the manor in Sussex, wakes on a ship crowded with prisoners driven by the wind's stiff whip toward Massachusetts Bay. A German baron loses a battle against King Wilhelm. His son and daughter-in-law flee. Their son, Bill Lang, finds his way to California, proposes to Ada Peckham on a boat bobbing in the middle of a lake. With every breath I take, filling the elegant, finely branched trees of my lungs with oxygen, my mother's mother dies again of pneumonia in Massachusetts in the flu epidemic of 1918, and my mother comes over mountains, rivers, and plains to California, where she grows up to marry Bill and Ada's son. Over and over in my round and spindly cells, where the past softly breathes, my mother, who told no one she was descended from the pilgrims and the people of the first light who brought them corn and deer, names me Light. Over and over, I ask myself, where am I going? How will I know when I'm there?
That's Lucia Langday reading from Becoming an Ancestor. And what strikes me about that, as you do in most of your poetry, there's this connection with nature.
Yes, definitely. There's a connection with nature throughout my work. That's something that is very important to me. And I could read a poem about my youngest grandson called Naturalists. His name is Devlin, but he just came into this world with a fascination with nature that I deeply share with him. And he's now 5, but I wrote this when he was 2, Naturalists. 2 years old, he takes my hand, leads me to the blackberry vine growing on the fence in his backyard. They're not ripe yet, he explains, then points to a small hole in the earth. The ants live there. I need a digging stick, he announces, holding up a fragile twig and shaking his head. This one's no good. I hand him a thicker stick. Perfect. In a shady corner near the patio, he digs and makes a find. It's a roly-poly in a ball, he says. I hold out my hand to receive the woodlouse, a terrestrial crustacean. Gretchen and I called them pill bugs in first grade when we found them with ants and Jerusalem crickets. Careful, my grandson warns, a pincher bug. It will pinch you. He points to an earwig, an insect with cerci, forceps on its abdomen. It's had 5 molts before becoming an adult. Someday I will tell him this, and that females have straight pinchers, males curved ones. Today, though, he's the teacher, and I'm his eager pupil, standing in light while blackberries ripen and a woodlouse unrolls.
Thank you. You yourself have been in your life involved in science education.
Yes.
And what a joy to be able to do it with your own family. Your chapbook is Dreaming of Sunflowers, Museum Poems. What's at the heart of this book? Because you also in your life have been involved with museums.
That's right. Yes, I was a director of a small museum called the Hall of Health, and there actually are some poems at the end of this book about the Hall of Health. But all of the poems in this book spring from my visits to museums and historical sites. But they're not only about the museums and historical sites. They're about my own life and experience, too.
Do you want to read something from that?
Maybe I'll read the poem that the title comes from. And this poem is called Vincent's Bedroom in Arles. The upstairs room in the yellow house across the street from the Roman arena in Arles is almost as he painted it. Bowl and pitcher on a small table, two chairs, a bed with yellow sheets and a red comforter. The only difference, a second small table with a box for the artist's brushes and palette. For a few euros, you can enter this fiction, the actual corner house that Vincent rented from Widow Venisak in 1888 was hit by an Allied bomb blown into history. But who can say what's real? The same Provençal sun warms this house as the one where he wanted to fill his guest room with paintings of sunflowers. I want to make it into a true artist's house, he wrote. Everything from the chairs to the pictures should have character. And if this character is captured by designers who copied his room here on a street where he must have walked, perhaps this is now a true artist's house, too, where one could go mad dreaming of sunflowers.
Who's to say what's real?
Right.
Yes, yes.
Right. And I could read maybe one more called Last Day in Amsterdam, and I picked this one because I know because you've interviewed my husband, and we visited Amsterdam together, and this poem begins with a romantic morning with him. Last Day in Amsterdam. We make love in our room with 15-foot ceilings and a vinyl Rembrandt behind the bed, then lunch on leftover sandwiches. Afterward, we buy fusidic acid for pink eye at the apotheque on the corner and almond cookies at a bakery nearby. Walking to the Hermitage in chilly May wind, while dappled sunlight pokes through clouds hanging in low bunches, as they often do here, I keep my hands deep in my pockets so my fingertips won't turn white. The canals, lined with black, red, pink, gray, brown, and beige brick houses, glitter everywhere the thin light strikes them. The paintings at the Hermitage are by Rubens, Van Dyck, Jordaens, and Teniers. Dancing peasants, witches cooking, and wilted tulips please me more than biblical figures, kings and queens, and all the dead fish. Tomorrow we'll board a train to Paris. Thin-blade modern windmills, enough propellers to lift the whole country, will be turning. Sliced by irrigation channels, the flat green landscape will quickly slip by. I'll remember dodging bicycles outside the mellow yellow coffee shop with its hookah in the window. Climbing steep stairs to the small dark rooms of Anne Frank's secret annex, and watching women in bright bikinis with jewels in their navels beckon from red light windows while talking on their cell phones and smiling, maybe feeling sorry for all the dowdy women in blue jeans who also do it every day but don't get paid.
Great. That's Lucille Langday, Dreaming of Sunflowers Museum Poems, and her other just released volume is Becoming an Ancestor. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, too.
Lucille Langday. Her recent works are Dreaming of Sunflowers, Museum Poems, and Becoming an Ancestor. Lucy is married to Richard Levine, who we heard earlier in the broadcast, and I couldn't resist bringing them back into the studio together.
I find it a curiosity how, both as writers and as published authors, how you manage that. Do you work together? Do you review each other's work? Do you have your separate spaces? Just domestically, how does that work? Because writing is such a solitary activity.
We have home offices that are right next door to each other. And we do show each other our work after we write it, and we get feedback from each other, but we don't usually collaborate. In fact, once we had a terrible time collaborating, just writing one sentence in a guest book at a B&B where we stayed.
It took us 45 minutes to agree on a sentence.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Now, I've read both of your work, and it's different. You do have different styles, so that doesn't surprise me that you might have had a different approach to writing one sentence. But you do share each other's work and give each other feedback in a structured way?
We do. I don't know how Lucy feels, but Lucy's a very good critic of my work, and it's partly that she doesn't run all over me, but is very pointed in her criticism, usually suggests one or two things in a story, for example, that I could work on, and she's almost always right.
Yes, and I think he's really helpful to me, too. Yeah, actually, he didn't even write poetry until we got together, and I guess he got inspired going to poetry readings with me and having me take my poems to him and for feedback, and he turned out to be a very good, not only a good critic of poetry, but he turned out to be able to write some wonderful poetry himself.
But narrative is really what I'm interested in, and so I may write more poems, but I wanted to complete this one collection, and I'm sure I'm never going to catch up to Lucy's 8 books of poetry or whatever.
And we will have you read in 10 seconds here. I thought it was interesting in your book, Bad Blood, that poetry was kind of central, and it was peppered throughout, and it made me think that you were a poet and that you had that threaded through there. But now I find out that it was maybe later coming.
Yes, it was later. Originally, I just thought Marlene Olive's poetry was going to be a terrific element, in an unusual element in the narrative of this murder story. It was one of the things that attracted me to the original story.
Well, why don't we hear something from your volume that is called Catch?
Catch and Other Poems. And I think I'll read the first poem, the title poem. The book is divided into a number of parts, and this is the first of a number of poems about childhood. Catch. One of us would say, let's play catch, and we'd all grab our oil-treated gloves and a hardball and go jouncing down the bumpy hill in the big brown beat-up Buick with loose suspension to the town park on Long Island Sound. The grass was new mown in rectilinear patterns or overgrown, feather soft and dandelion strewn. We'd spread out and shout, liner, drive me back, high fly, grounder, send me wide, and Dad would comply unerringly. Homer's heroes had nothing on the Dodgers we imagined being, fleet-footed Amoros and strong-armed Furillo, or the Duke, prowling center so confidently he'd make the toughest play seem a snap. Not us. We'd make the easiest seem hard to show off all our stuff, leaping high to snag a fly a little overhead, or driving for a line drive close by and rolling to a stop. Even on cloudy days, I'd cup my eyes with both hands, waiting for the ball to drop out of a blinding sun in the nick of time, then turn to fire home, where Dad would wince in mock pain to show how much it burned, or pretend to be Campanella, tagging out the winning runs, sliding to the plate. Or he'd clap his hands silently in the distance. What bliss. It's funny, I don't recall my father giving me advice about girls and sex or how to be a man or deal with loss. All we did was toss a ball. I don't remember sharing dreams or secrets with my brother. Catch was how we talked to one another. Sometimes when I read this poem, I offer to give away a free copy of the book to anyone who can name the 1956 Brooklyn Dodgers starting lineup.
And sometimes people are there who can do that. <That's right. laughs>
No, I couldn't come close. Couldn't come close. And Lucille, will you read another one for us?
Yes, I think I'm going to read a poem in which Richard appears, since Richard is here. And this is from Becoming an Ancestor, and this is called The Lost Necklaces. Searching through drawers and jewelry boxes, unable to find it, anxiety rising, I tell my husband, I can't find the iridescent necklace you gave me. Do you remember it? Did I dream or imagine it? He can't recall an iridescent necklace, but wants to know what I did with the necklace from Mexico he gave me last year. It was very expensive. I don't remember a necklace from Mexico. He doesn't remember what it looked like. Two missing necklaces. I feel awful. How it must hurt him. I've lost two necklaces he gave me, and I can't even remember one of them. Frantic, back upstairs, I look again through drawers, find a red box, in it an iridescent necklace. He says it's Mexican opal, set in silver. I didn't remember it was from Mexico. He didn't remember it was iridescent. There are no lost necklaces. We are only losing our minds.
That's true enough.
Well, thank you both for coming in and sharing your work with us. I could listen to you read the whole book, probably. Thank you, Lucille Langday and Richard Michael Levine.
And thank you, too.
Thanks, Suzanne.
I'm Suzanne Lang, descendant of Baron von Lang, and you've been listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea. You can listen to our podcast at krcb.org. Subscribe and listen through iTunes. We've had production assistance from Sean Knight and Mark Prell. Thanks for listening. It's a Novel Idea.